Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio, WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont. Todd Tyson in the studio, Henry Swayze on the line from the Queen City. We will be speaking with him and we're going to talk a little bit about AI. I think you know what that stands for in these modern times. Before I play a little bit of music about The Grid from Leo Kottke and Vermonter Mike Gordon, I do want to acknowledge the underwriters that keep Green Zine cooking for more than 11 years here. Solaflect, the moving solar panel company based down in Norwich, Vermont. Bale, you can find out more about Bale, which is located here on the Commons in South Royalton by going to their website, balevt.org. Royal Trail Works, fixing up a lot of trails for skiing and riding and also designing snowmaking systems. Thank you, Tom Wells, the owner of that company here in Royalton. Daniel Leibowitz, longtime supporter of the radio station. The Upper Pass Beer Company, a small farmhouse brewery at an undisclosed location in Tunbridge, Vermont. The First Branch Coffee Company, they're located right here in downtown South Royalton. Solarfest and the White River Land Collaborative, located over in Tunbridge, Vermont. Let's head over to The Grid. We'll be talking about some solar power a little bit later in the show.
I was a kid, was to run out to the wilderness and live off the grid. So I built my hut far from where other people did, but somehow it just still felt like living on the grid. Yeah.
Good luck if you are living off the grid or you're thinking about going off the grid. It is doable. That is Leo Kottke and Mike Gordon. I believe that was Mike doing the vocals there. Henry, you probably have experienced living off the grid in a way, correct?
I have. I grew up spending all my weekends and summers off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in the bad old days when solar panels hadn't yet even been invented.
Yeah, we're talking probably the 50s, eh? Maybe even
the 40s.
Even the 40s, Henry. You did just have a birthday, but we already blew out all the candles. And hey, I'm glad to have you on with me again after all these, ever since last week. Here we are on Green Zine.
Yeah. It's interesting when you live in a place that's not on the grid, and especially if you are an early off-gridder, even with solar panels, with really limited power budget, it reshapes your day. You start not lighting up the whole house in the evening, and then it becomes sitting around a light or two and doing more peaceful things in the evening. It's probably good for the human soul. It's something that we should turn the main circuit breaker off every once in a while.
Yeah, and it definitely makes you, when you are living off the grid, but you do have electricity because you're getting it from hydro or you're getting, local hydro or from most likely from solar panels out on a pole or maybe up on your roof, that you really do consider not only your usage in real time, but then if something's changed where you need to bring in a new appliance? You know, are you going to get a dryer? Do you need to upgrade your refrigerator? You are really going to carefully check out how many watts those appliances, and you might even decide, or maybe a water pump. You know, is there a big difference in the electric usage of a 3/4 horsepower or a 1 horsepower water pump? Some big decisions can be driven. And as far as, hey, let's get satellite TV and all the rest of that, maybe that's just a no-go. And then you can spend more time reading by candlelight, right?
Right. So we covered maybe 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we did a brief mention on a book, which I was recently exposed to through a TED Talk. Actually, there's a TED Talk on it, The Importance of Having Fun. And one of the questions it asks you is, if you think back through your life, what were the things that were really fun, times that you were really having fun, specific times? And one of the times I can remember was shortly after moving to Vermont, having a it was Christmas time, and having my brother and sister-in-law, we had no children yet at that point, and they were up for Christmas, and we had a power outage that lasted for 2 days. And we sat down and played Mahjong for about 4 hours straight one evening by kerosene light. And it was lots of fun. Mm. The rest of the world went away. It was just being in the moment and enjoying yourself.
Yeah, it makes me think of a song, but I won't start singing on the air. I'll relate a nature-related fun when I look back, and this didn't happen too many years ago. I went on a bike ride up in the Braintree area just above Randolph, and I was trying to retrace where I had gotten lost on a previous, not seriously lost, during a big bike event up there that Zach Freeman puts on. And I got to a point where I said, okay, hey, I've got it figured out. So I've been riding maybe for 45 minutes or so, and then I'm riding along, and I realize, you know what? You somehow missed the turn. I don't know where it was, but it's behind you. But I had a general idea where I was going. I figured I was kind of going towards Roxbury. I was in an area I'd never been in. It was beautiful. It was late spring. Things were dry, and I kept riding along for another hour, saw some old forest roads and a couple of old cellar holes, and ended up on a road, actually Cram Hill Road, if you're familiar with that area. And suddenly I was kind of found, because I am familiar with that road, and I realized, well, you're gone far enough north, you're going to have to drop down to pavement and ride back. But during that time of sort of being lost, but not being nervous about it, because I knew that, well, eventually I'm going to come out on some sort of navigable spot. Being isolated, but on a beautiful day out in nature, that was a lot of fun, for sure. And people that get out and hike and bike and go bird watching and things like that, I think they would probably put those activities right near the top.
We should get on with Bird Note.
We should.
Look at keystone species.
Yeah, I've got it lined up and looking at a very attractive woodpecker that I'm not familiar with that one. I don't think the one that's in this photo is from around here, Henry.
Well, the yellow-bellied sapsucker is something we have. And,
ooh, yes.
And I think that might be the picture. I forgot.
Okay, that's what, yeah. I guess I haven't seen one of them close up. It's a beautiful-looking bird, but can be pretty destructive. All right, let's go to Bird Note now. You're listening to Green Scene with Henry Swayze and Todd Tyson. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Henry will let you know who we're going to be speaking with. Here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. With steady, resounding whacks of its chisel-like bill, a woodpecker excavates a nesting cavity in a tree. A pair of woodpeckers will use the hole for one nesting season, carving out a new one the following spring. But unlike most birds, whose nests are good for just one season, the woodpecker's cavity will have a long and useful career. Woodpeckers, master carpenters of the bird world, are called keystone species for their crucial role in creating habitat suited to other woodland wildlife. Abandoned woodpecker nest holes become nests or roosts for small owls, like this northern saw-whet owl, or cavity-nesting wood ducks. Swifts, bluebirds, swallows, wrens, and other birds, as well as many mammals, make use of these holes. The snags can become multi-level condominiums for a whole host of wildlife. A venerable dead tree, broken off at the top and perforated with multiple cavities, may actually be one of the most valuable trees in the forest. It's satisfying to know that some simple choices can improve habitat for birds. For example, if you have to cut down a tree, consider leaving part of it as a snag. You'll be helping the woodpeckers and all the species that depend on them for homes. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Very informative BirdNote there. Henry, and lots of great sound effects from our feathered friends.
Yeah. So they pretty much mine, make big holes in dead wood. So they actually aren't destroying trees. They're just nice nest sites. And a brief note on the keystone species. So they're a keystone species because they make space for other wildlife to follow. They increase the diversity in the area. And there are many other keystone species, and beavers do it. They flood ground, hold water on the ground, make the summer drought and flood level out. Starfish eat sea anemones. And you'd say, well, that's evil. We don't want starfish. But in fact, when you remove them from an ecosystem, the anemones take over and totally dominate the area and turn it into a wasteland.
Wow.
Because it's a monoculture. And gray wolves are a keystone species because they keep buffalo moving and wildlife moving, which creates rotational grazing and builds soil. So the keystone species are things that make the environment really tick.
Yeah, that's a great review of the keystone species. Henry, could you just give us a 30-second blurb on our guest and the topic, and then I want to jump in and tell folks about Green Up Day.
Right. So our guest is Josiah Racine, and he's the first person we've ever had. He is the Vermont AI director. Artificial Intelligence Director. So we're going to talk to him about why does Vermont bother having an AI director, and what's the good and the bad of it, and what do we need to do?
Okay, really looking forward to that. It seems like not more than 2 or 3 days goes by without me seeing some major article, either in a newspaper or in a magazine, about the good, the bad, and the ugly of artificial intelligence. All right, everybody who's lived in Vermont for a while, even if you've only been here for a year, you know that Green Up Day is always the first Saturday in May, and that is the case this year. Get out on your local roads and clean up, and if you are in Tunbridge, they're going to be having Green Up Day, and bags are available right outside. In fact, I was just there yesterday outside the public library on the porch, on the bench. They'll also be handed out at the transfer station this Saturday, the 27th of April, also when it's open on Wednesday, May 1st. And, of course, you can get them. You can bring in those bags full of trash. I would recommend that you separate out the recyclables and redeem those. Yeah, don't be throwing aluminum cans and redeemable bottles into the Green Up bag. Not such a good idea. You can bring those bags into Tunbridge anytime between May 1st and 11th, and there will be no charge. There's more information about Tunbridge Green Up Day here in the Herald. You can get your Bob and Ed bucks, etc. Just about every other town is going to be having Green Up Day. Sharon Green Up Day is also happening. They're going to be offering a community lunch from 12:30 to 2 p.m. as part of that. You can find more out about that on page A5. There's also notes about the Green Up Day over in Rochester. I was doing a little greening up on a road that's actually in Tunbridge, but not near me. I was told, Henry, about a major can dump, and I will reveal that it's on Monarch Hill Road, or it was on Monarch Hill Road, unless that guy's come by. And all the cans, pretty much across the board, were the same size, the same brewer product. And Henry, they were big cans, 107 of them.
Oh, it sounds like you might have handled some of those.
Yeah. Yeah, it took a little while. I had to go down a really steep bank because they had drifted down the bank. And a local neighbor came by and said, I can't believe it. Somebody's actually cleaning up. That's been there for the last year. So I don't know. Hopefully that person will get the message. We'll see. But that's Green Up Day coming up a week from this Saturday, May 4th.
And gathering up aluminum cans and getting them in recycling, there is a great deal of energy goes into making a new aluminum can. If you make it out of an old aluminum can, it takes far less energy.
Yep. So. Good thing to know. And I know they're a little sloppy picking them up out of the mud and everything. And, you know, you should clean them up. Don't be trying to take them to a redemption center when they're all mucked up. You got to tidy them up. But a lot of them are in good shape. They just have some road dirt on them.
Right.
Hey, one other thing I want to mention, we're going to get to this in the third of the show, and that is a major bill was sort of put into effect on Earth Day, which was this past Monday, by Senator Biden. In fact, there's a photo with Bernie there next to Senator Sanders, next to President Biden, and it is a bill designed, a national bill, and a lot of that money, $62 million actually, is going to come to the state of Vermont to help low-income and medium-income people become part of the renewable energy grid with solar power. So we'll discuss that a little bit more in the third of the show.
So I want to flag two things. One is that in our notes, which are already up for today's show, you will find a calculator that tells you just how much you can get. You put in how much you are making and what your zip code is, what your household income is, and whether you're a single household or eight of you in the household, whatever it is, and it will tell you what programs are available now for you and what programs are available next year, because some of those things are worth waiting for rather than doing now, and some of them now is perfect. So there's a link to that calculator. And it's a complex subject, so having a calculator that does it all for you is a great step up. And I have one other thing that's in the notes. My partner was reading about trilliums, and trilliums are ephemerals. They are the first plants that start blooming in the spring in wildflowers.
Yep.
And they basically take advantage of the time when there's no leaf cover on the trees, and they store all their food for the year before the leaves shade them out. And trilliums, when you pick them, you actually make it so they don't have those food reserves stored. And they are goners, basically, because of that. So look and enjoy, but don't pick the trilliums. And there's a great extensive article on them. It takes 7 years for a trillium to first bloom, and they can last in the ground for 25 to 50 years.
Wow. Yeah. I knew they were very sensitive and you shouldn't pick them, but I didn't realize that they could stick around for 25 years. And it is very tempting when you're getting out on the trails with spring finally arriving here in Vermont to see a trillium or to see a trout lily, to see a jack in the pulpit, and to be tempted, oh boy, wouldn't that look good on my breakfast table at home? But no, just take a picture of it and post the picture on your breakfast table. And leave the trillium where it lies.
I'm going to get my guest, our guest.
All right. I'm going to bring you down to the mix. Henry's going to get our guest. We'll be talking AI, as in artificial intelligence, here on Green Zine in just a moment or so. It's 19 minutes past 11. Here's a program you may be interested in. I was just reading part of a book where one of the characters was threatening, maybe that isn't the right word, was thinking about becoming a vegetarian. I'm not sure it was for health reasons or for climate change reasons, but on that subject, there is going to be a talk, Reversing Climate Change Through Plant-Based Eating. And this is sent in by Abraham Ort, O-O-R-T. It's a program that's going to be happening at the Norwich Public Library. And that is coming up on Tuesday, the last day of April, April the 30th, from 6:30 to 8:30. Once again, down at the Norwich Public Library, Reversing Climate Change Through Plant-Based Eating, the Plant-Based Eating Initiative, a local group of concerned citizens, will present a program and audience-initiated panel discussion about what individuals can do to reverse climate change. And if you need more information on that, 802-281-6625. And I'm going to hit this button here because I think Henry may have gotten disconnected, but he might be back now after pushing that button. And I think he's going to be getting a hold of our guest. I'll try to bring him up. I want to let you folks, particularly if you're up in the Randolph Way, you're an active walker or a biker, or you do those activities in the Randolph area, they have just announced they are working on a walking and bicycling master plan. As part of the outreach for the plan, they are launching a walking and biking survey. The survey will collect information for residents and visitors about their experiences walking and biking in downtown Randolph, Randolph Center, and East Randolph, all areas that I'm very familiar with. This survey will help the town assess the current conditions and issues that pedestrians and bicyclists encounter. The survey responses will help shape the priorities of the walking and bicycling master plan. In addition to the survey, they're hosting a public forum, and I think this is where you can meet and greet some of the folks that are up there, fellow walkers, bikers, and outside visitors are welcome. You don't just have to be a resident of Randolph. That will be happening on Tuesday, May 7th at the Randolph House Conference Room. That's at 65 North Main Street in Randolph. From 6 to 8 p.m. preceding the public forum will be an open house from 4 to 6 p.m. I think there might be some goodies there to munch on. Public forum will give residents and visitors another opportunity to voice their experiences, concerns, and recommendations for the walking and bicycling master plan. We'll try to get this link. I'm sure there is notice of this in either in this week's Herald or certainly in next week's Herald. Once again, that is coming up on Tuesday, May the 7th. Henry, are you back with us?
I am, and I have Josiah Wraith with me, who is the director of AI for the state of Vermont. Imagine that. We're on the leading edge. So welcome to Green Zine, Josiah, and tell us how you came to be where you are, and why has the state of Vermont decided that it's important enough to actually have a directorship?
Well, thanks so much for having me. So back in the long ago, in 2018, Vermont launched an AI task force, and back then I was a developer embedded within VTrans, working on data analytics and a few AI projects for things like predicting how road pavement was going to behave over, 20 to 30 years life cycle of a project, and working on inventorying like road signs and things like that. You know, could we use AI for that type of problem? So, that was where I kind of learned to build AI tools and got some experience with that. Through that time, the task force looked at where AI was going and realized that the tech was going to be really transforming lots of different areas of society, and especially how Vermonters interacted with government. So in 2020, when they released their final report, they recommended that Vermont create a permanent division of AI, which would kind of guide the legislature on AI-related topics and then also oversee the use of artificial intelligence within state government. And so that's where my position came from.
You know, thinking about keeping track of how many road signs you have and how that's artificial intelligence, can we step back even one step further and just kind of say, well, you know, I mean, we're getting a lot of hype about AI doing our thinking for us, or the worry about that. Can you talk a little bit more broadly about just what the parameters of AI is and how that comes together?
Yeah, sure. So one of the interesting things with AI is the definition keeps changing. I was on with Oregon's AI Council, helping them get started last evening. And, you know, we talked about how AI over the last 100 years or so, since people had the idea that computers could someday think, how that kind of has changed definitions probably at least a dozen times. It started out with things like photocells, right? Like detect the amount of light entering the photocell and close a switch. And they called that a robot chemist. I have a newspaper clipping from the 1930s about how, you know, that was going to revolutionize chemistry to have things like photocells. And since then, like, the technology has changed and the definition of what is AI has changed. But I think the kind of working, the way that I think about it is AI is any capability of a computer that surprises us and makes us, you know, be like, well, I didn't know a computer could do that kind of thing. So, you know, when I started working with AI, it was really focused on a technology called neural networks, which is basically a really complex set of math problems that you give the computer examples and it adjusts its math problems until it can give you the right answer consistently for the different types of examples that you show it. And you can do things with that, like using a tool like Google Street View or a similar tool, look at the pixels in that image and say, is there a street sign in this image? And if so, what kind of sign is it? And so that was, you know, how we were inventorying road signs was a tool like that. In late 22, ChatGPT launched, of course, and the definition of AI kind of changed in the public consciousness again. And now when people talk about AI, they really mean generative AI, right? The ability of computers to kind of create text or create images based on a description of the thing that you want it to create.
And so one of the things maybe distinguishes AI or our technological world in general, actually, is that it's a building block process. And in the case of AI, it's a building block that's built into the technology. So it learns from its past mistakes. Am I right about that?
Yeah. When you're training an AI, you kind of have to tell it what, like how to think about when it gets a wrong answer. So, and thinking is a bit of a misnomer here, but when the AI gets something wrong, how bad is that and how bad of an error is it and how should it adjust its internal its internals in order to get the answer right the next time? So if it misclassifies, I'll keep using that road sign example, a yield sign as a stop sign, right? You have to tell it how bad of an error that is, and that helps the AI to determine how to adjust its internal weights so that it gets the answer closer to right in the future.
So just one more, and then I'll let you go, Todd. So one of the seemingly terrifying things about AI is that because it's learning from its mistakes and building on that its power is growing exponentially. It's growing on a more and more rapid path all the time. Am I right about that? And is that a problem? Do you see that as a problem?
I would say that there's a lot of hype right now around AI and what it can do, and I think there's a little bit more hype than there is actual capability at this point. So there's a lot of talk, especially from big tech, about the big scary AI topics like rogue AI taking over the nuclear arsenal or the singularity, however whoever is talking defines what the singularity is, or AI sentience, again, like not well defined, but those are all things that are like feel a little bit like disaster voyeurism to me, right? They're these really big scary things that maybe could happen in the future. But what I'm finding is that some of the larger tech companies are using that to distract people from the issues that are actually like present today. There are person level risks things that we can control as individuals and at the state level, and things that we can do about them. So I can give some examples if that's helpful. But I think that sometimes those kind of big topics can be fun and instructive to explore, like how could it be? But we're not at risk from any of those things at this point. What we're at risk from are things that are much more kind of boring but tangible, like disinformation or the quality of work or personal autonomy dropping. And yeah, happy to give some examples of those. But
yeah, and I want to just go back to the highways again. And as someone who knows a bit about EVs and charging and everything, we know that Tesla was making a big effort early on. I think they backed off quite a bit about self-driving cars. And I believe that a lot of that was based on AI, understanding what was going on with signs and on the roadway. And there have been some bad accidents. And I think they've kind of backed off. I think the whole movement towards self-driving vehicles has slowed down quite a bit. So maybe just a two-part question, or where I want to dip into. One is sort of the ethical component, and particularly keeping in mind that a lot of these big companies are the biggest companies in the world as far as profitability and potential political influence. So the ethical component of designing some future AI, is it really for the benefit of humanity, or is it a hybrid between profits and benefits to humanity? And then secondly, if we could talk about some examples, some positive examples about how AI can help us improve our environment and limit the effects of climate change.
Yeah, I'll just explore that idea of self-driving vehicles a little bit. I think what we've found is that, and this is applicable way beyond self-driving vehicles, to make something fully autonomous, it has to be able to handle any possible situation that comes up, and to do that reliably and kind of better than if you had a person doing that job. I think what you've seen, instead of like full like robo-taxi type of a scenario, is you've seen AI pop up in a lot of smaller pieces, smaller components that improve the driving experience overall. So some examples, if you have a car that has like super cruise or lane keeping, right? That's AI under the hood. That's looking at the road and figuring out how far, how fast is the traffic in front of you going? What are the road stripes looking like? Can it figure out where it is on the road? That's where we've actually seen AI come into the driving experience and make it, I think, better, especially for those long drives. Now, does it work on every road? No. Go try to use your Super Cruise on a dirt road. You'll find out that like the AI can't handle that situation at this point. But we're seeing AI that's a little bit more task-oriented, good at kind of one piece of a broader system of things that need to happen, and providing assistance in that space. So I think, and that's the approach we're taking in Vermont too. We're talking about AI as power tools for particular tasks. And in the same way, you wouldn't have a robotic nail gun try to build you a house. Like, that's not going to have good outcomes. A nail gun in the hand of a skilled operator, right, makes it a lot better work and a lot more efficient. And so if we look at AI in a particular task context, we can avoid a lot of the risks and a lot of the downsides and drive the outcomes that we're looking for.
And then the ethical component about large corporations who do have the money to invest in R&D and developing AI. Do you have any sense at the state level? There are contracts that are going to be signed by many states and many countries that are based on the capabilities of AI, sort of keeping an eye on the ethics versus the profits of large corporations who are responsible for the development of AI?
Yeah, I think we've released for Vermont a code of ethics that has been adopted by several other states at this point on how we want AI to be used and how we expect any solution that includes AI that's implemented within our environment to operate. So we're looking at that as really needing to make the experience of the people doing the work or the people interacting with the tool better. Stanford, I think, has done a lot of work on this. They call it human-centered AI. And that's the paradigm that we are looking for. So what I don't want is, you know, somebody to apply for a driver's license renewal or something like that and get an automatic rejection and have no recourse. We're not going to implement AI tools in that way. What we are going to do is streamline processes. So if it's like, yes, you filled out everything correctly and we can automatically approve it, and maybe you can get your answer in minutes instead of days or weeks, we think that that's a customer service to everyone and frees up people to handle the more complicated cases where we need to have follow-up or conversations and kind of dig in a little bit more detail.
I see.
So is that your job as AI director to help systems work in a more user-friendly way?
Yes, a lot of got both a kind of a policy side, that code of ethics, and then also a technical implementation and oversight side to my role, which is helping to think about how do we get good outcome AI systems we implement. If it's okay, I'll give one example, not from the state of Vermont, but I think it's helpful to thinking about how we design AI systems. There was a hotel chain that implemented an AI system that, based on when people were checking in and checking out of rooms, it would send housekeeping staff to those rooms and kind of be more efficient about when rooms were cleaned. And I think the idea was that ultimately it would provide better, you know, the rooms would always be ready when you showed up at the hotel, and it would take less staff to do the work. What they found, though, was that the way that they implemented had a huge impact on their workforce. So they tried doing it two different ways. One way, they just told staff, here's the next room you're going to. And they found that actually made it much worse to work in those housekeeping roles, because the AI was not thinking about how far the person might have to walk to get from one room to another, or go to another floor to get a piece of equipment and bring it up, you know, having to go across the hallways more than once, going down and up. And just, there were a lot more steps. The work became a lot more physically demanding with that type of an AI implementation. Another way to do it was to give the housekeeping staff more autonomy about the order in which they did things. So it would say, hey, here's the next three or five rooms that need to be cleaned, and then let people choose which rooms are going to be done from that list and give them a little bit more personal autonomy. And that made the work actually a lot better. So I think there are, how we implement AI, how much personal autonomy we make sure remains available to our workers, makes a big difference in how successful we will be and in how good the work is in these kind of new collaborative environments where people are working alongside of machines. What we don't want to do is have our workers, either at the state or Vermonters who are working in these kind of jobs, basically become extensions of the computer, right? The human arms and legs of the computer to go do stuff. We want it to always be where a human is using a power tool to get a job done, not the people as kind of a cog in the machine.
All right, that feels good. So let me jump to a whole other kind of area. I understand that Microsoft is building between 3 and 5 new data centers every single week, and that the drive for sorting information, maybe that's a way of putting it, is using a lot of computing power and making, you know, when you do a Google search or a search with any computer search engine, you land up with a whole lot of information being sorted and prioritized and given to you. And this takes, this apparently takes a lot of electricity. It's one of the things that is beginning to be one of the first things that is increasing power demand across the country before things like electric vehicles are fully adopted and heat pumps, the transition from fossil fuels to heat pumps has only really just begun. Do you have any comments about that energy demand and about whether this is more of a problem for where power is really cheap and the and Microsoft or other companies tend to want to base their data centers because of that cheap power, or will this have an effect on the Vermont grid as well?
I can't speak to the Vermont grid specifically. I haven't heard any like tangible plans to site data centers here in Vermont. I'll say that as we're thinking about power consumption, especially as it relates to AI, the majority, or I'll say the big draw on power consumption is actually when we train a new AI model. So if you're training a model, say to do sign recognition, you have to show it billions to trillions of examples in order for it to be able to recognize those successfully. When you actually go to run the model once it's trained, that you can do on your phone, on a laptop, on an embedded device, or it can run in a data center. But the actual, like each individual search, each individual example, at that point, there's kind of very little power draw, and actually a bit less in most instances than if you use kind of a more traditional programming approach to solving the same problem.
And clearly, once you've got that training done, that is then way more efficient for the human interaction with that, having to sort through that data set.
Yes, I know that from a grid perspective, yes, where power is cheap is becoming a big consideration for where they put those. I think my wife grew up in Pennsylvania, and near her house, there's a nuclear power plant, and they're actually taking an old industrial site that was adjacent to that power plant and turning that into a data center because they've got basically an unlimited supply of power adjacent to them. And that's an easy thing to do. So I think there is an opportunity to repurpose some of our, and mostly in other states, but there might be some opportunities here too, but some of our existing vacant manufacturing properties and turn those into data centers because they already have the infrastructure and they're already generally pretty well sited for where there's power available either. And we should focus on making sure that that's power that's renewable in some way.
Yes.
I have a sort of I think this is an example of AI, and Henry and I have talked about this before. So when we think about the smart grid and people being able to control their thermostat from their phone, change things, set a timer so that your EV is going to draw power only from midnight until 6 a.m. when the grid is not really being used that much. That seems to be a lot of efficiencies and also probably would save the consumer money since they're not tapping into the grid at a high usage time. Are those developments, are those examples of AI and how they can be beneficial to our environment?
Yeah, certainly the planning for a smart grid is now largely powered by AI. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we see more renewables, which tend to be a little bit burstier than traditional, like, I don't know, coal-fired or other, you know, when you could basically steady state the production of power from those other sources. We will certainly be using more AI as we kind of blend the mix of solar and wind and hydro in order to kind of provide energy just in time at the right level for the demand that's happening right now.
Excellent.
All right. Any final thoughts that you want to import or in part, and you want to promote any services that that your department is offering, or is that a danger zone you don't want to go to?
Well, there are a couple of things that I would just, you know, mention to folks who are listening. One of the things that historically we've been able to do is, you know, you could look at something you read, say on the internet or even in print, and you could look at the quality of what was written. Like, does it have typos? Like, is it well formatted? Does it feel like English? And you could use that to gauge the quality of the actual ideas in the content. And in the age of generative AI, that's not the case anymore, right? I can create a very good-looking policy proposal that we should get local farms to offer dairy-free creamies to drive up tourism, right? That's a silly idea. I think hopefully we could all agree that, you know, having farms import stuff and sell it as a locally made thing is you know, not a great plan. But if I use a generative AI tool, I can make that seem really, really plausible and believable. And so just like practice a healthy level of skepticism as you're interacting with content, especially online. That hopefully isn't a new idea to anyone, but we're certainly seeing it being very important coming into the election season, especially with so much AI generated, both images and text circulating right now.
So what do you think the possibility of having to watermark everything that is AI generated?
I think watermarks are potentially a good idea. The challenge with how I've seen them implemented so far is it's hard for a human to tell whether something was generated by AI, and it's very easy for a bad guy to crop it out, right? Yeah. So I think it's part of the solution. But in general, you know, check your source, right? Is this a reputable source, or is this, you know, a random Facebook page that's being run by a Russian troll farm where this originated, right? Like, do some research before resharing something, and then just be skeptical of stuff that's really inflammatory. We're seeing a lot of people generating fake content with AI or with traditional ways of telling lies on the internet that are trying to just create inflammatory discourse. And I think that's doing a disservice to all of us, and just, you know, be a little bit skeptical.
And that's harnessing a natural human reaction. When we get angry about something, we take action on it. So we say, oh, well, let's pass this on and fire it down the chain. Is that part of your job description, to try to figure out how to rein that in?
It's something that we're thinking about, and I'm having conversations with, like, Secretary of State around some of these topics and the legislature. I don't know that any of our legislative proposals are going to make it for this year, specifically on AI. But we are doing a lot of work on data privacy, which we didn't really get to talk about. But I think that's a big piece of regulating AI and how it's used is, you know, how much of your data is it allowed to slurp up and learn from. So there, like, this is a big topic. But
another program.
Yeah, exactly.
But go ahead and put the butt in if you like it, and give it the 2 cents.
Yeah, this is part of my role is around this educational component, and I'm really excited to talk to Vermonters about you know, how they can improve how they're interacting online. And I think AI has the opportunity to make our jobs better, to help us to do more meaningful and productive work. I talk in my group about the difference between robot work and people work, right? And people work is the part that's meaningful and productive and interacting with other humans and doing the work that brings you joy, and not the rote kind of mindless parts of your job. So AI can get us there, I think. We have to apply it smartly and use it well.
Well, we will have to come back and do other programs with you. I think you're right in the heart of decision making for how to keep life getting better instead of getting just more corporate or more profit oriented or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we really really appreciate you joining us, Josiah, and good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. Have a good one.
Right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Henry, we've got about 9.5 minutes to go in the show. I know we wanted to talk about this new solar bill that's coming out of the federal government. Should we jump into that, or did you want to bring up something else first?
No, sure, let's do that.
Yeah, so this is, you could find just a brief kind of overview in the current issue of 7 Days. There's our senator standing there, he is our senior senator, Senator Sanders, and it's titled Solar Heats Up. The state of Vermont will receive $62.4 million from a new federal program that aims to make solar power more affordable for low-income residents. The APA announced the award on Earth Day as part of a $7 billion initiative called Solar for All. And as Henry was talking about earlier, this is coming out of the IRA money that's been doling out over the last few years. We even got the EPA administrator to visit. I don't think we're going to have either of the presidential candidates visit Vermont, but Michael Regan came up here to join Senator Sanders. As far as who will benefit from this, over 900,000 households nationwide. The initial program will build 5 kilowatt arrays. It does mention community solar here, Henry. So we were talking last week with our guest, former Avram Pratt, about whether group net metering was going to be able to continue or be ramped up. And it was kind of a little bit shaky there, but it looks like maybe this program, some low and medium income folks could end up being part of a community solar project. So pretty interesting. I think it's basically a good news article. Maybe we could talk to a solar installer about their impressions sometime in the future.
Yeah. So within in the notes, the first note is on Rewire America, their calculator that we mentioned earlier, and that has calculations for low income people can get solar panels paid for free, and if you are want to make your house more efficient by tightening it up, there's money for that as well. And it's all in that calculator. So it's a whole, it's a whole green energy footprint calculator with the dollars that you can get paid for doing those things. And there are payments that kind of ramp down as your income level goes up and up. And as we've mentioned probably many times before, because it's startling to me, it's the bottom 60% of Vermont households that have the biggest energy burden in relationship to their income levels. In other words, they have to the efficiency with which they heat and cool and drive and so forth has a much bigger impact on their quality of life than it is for the people above that level. So they tend to reduce the funding availability for the people above. And a lot of the federal programs tax rebates, which the lower income people frequently can't collect those tax.
No, they wouldn't qualify for those.
Yeah. Because they aren't paying enough tax to have a reduction help. And the top people, top income earners, were able to take those. And this is an attempt to reverse that process and weight it towards the people, or at least give mammoth boost up for the people at the bottom. There's
right.
quite a lot of stuff that's free.
And a figure here that if someone was to put a 5-kilowatt array up at their home, it would probably cost about $18,000. Now, if you're a lower income person, that is just not going to be doable. This program will stretch that out over a period of years to pay it back at an affordable rate. And in the end, for the lifetime of those plants, it could save quite a bit of money for those individual households. And it certainly would help the state of Vermont to have those high energy burden folks using more renewable energy rather than dirty energy and spending more for dirty energy.
Yeah. So that's in that note. And then there's also on the same subject that I was raising with the grid and with AI being one of the things that's demanding lots and lots more power as each week goes along. It's really ramping up fast in terms of power consumption. And there is a Volts podcast that just is from yesterday that gets into this, and it looks at places like Georgia where there's a lot of greening of industry and greening of data centers going there and things like that, and their knee-jerk reaction is to put in gas-fired power plants in order to have the electricity for this. And the podcast goes through and talks about how it can be done other ways, and that the utilities like to do what they know already, what they've already done before, and trip down the wrong path. So that's interesting podcast.
Very good. Henry, any thoughts on who may be one of our future guests? I am going to try to get the interim director of the Environmental Law School Clinic to join us in the future. I have a direct line to him, courtesy of former board member of the radio station, Maureen Moriarty. His name is Mark James. So I can't say that we'd have him on next week, but probably in a couple of weeks. And we'll probably be talking quite a bit of solar with him. Who else do you have in your potential queue?
Well, I have no one who I've invited for next week. So
okay.
We're flexible.
We are flexible. And maybe one of our listeners has an idea. Maybe you could give them your email address. They might have
sure.
A, yeah.
And so I'm Henry, so my email address is now at the top of the
At our link at the website. Nice.
At our link in the website, henryswayze@gmail.com.
Excellent. Check in with Henry. Maybe you're building a straw bale house and want to talk about it. Maybe you're going to go off-grid for the first time and you'd like to share that with our listeners. Always open to innovative, creative ideas on how to live a little bit less carbon intensive on the planet. Henry, I'm going to take a moment to thank our underwriters here on Green Zine, and they do include the White River Land Collaborative. They just had a couple of walking workshops there recently. Dandelion Acres Garden Center, Solar Fest, I Care For You, and South Royalton Market. And that's about it. We're playing a little bit of a waltz, Henry. This is from a brand new CD from Wendy Grossman, and she is playing the auto harp. I hope you can hear that auto harp out there, Henry. And this name of this waltz is not Griselda's waltz. This is the Surveillance Waltz. So AI could be keeping an eye on you, Henry. Be careful.
Surveillance waltz. Yes.
Yep, it's a surveillance waltz.
I guess that's what we were used to do when we were waltzing on the formal ballroom floors. We were out there strutting our stuff to be surveilled.
Yeah, back in the day. All right, thanks, Henry. Got less than a minute to go. Democracy Now! Coming up. Always great to talk with you. We'll see you next week. And stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont.